Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Back in April of 2011, we featured independent scholar Robert Coote discussing America's most favorite hymns and why Amazing Grace did not make that list. It happened to be one of my most favorite interviews since I love music, including hymns, but I know virtually nothing about how those songs get to my ear holes. Our discussion back then focused largely on religious music that was written during the 17th and 18th centuries, and how various works became permanent fixtures in the hymnals of different denominations. Many of my favorite hymns that were written around the late 19th century and earliest 20th century, such as The Old Rugged Cross and I'll Fly Away, didn't make Mr. Coote's list of popular hymns since they were, quote-unquote, too new to have been featured in several editions of these hymnals. At the end of that podcast, we briefly turned our attention to the contemporary Christian music scene, which has seen an explosion of popularity in the past two decades, with many musicians becoming successful crossover artists that are popular even among secular audiences, such as Amy Grant, Jars of Clay, Stryper, and MXPX. That prompted me to seek out somebody who was in the contemporary Christian music industry to find out what's been going on in that scene. With the help of my good friends Millie and James Snook, who are connected with Show Hope, a Christian-based adoption organization that is championed by Christian music superstar Stephen Curtis Chapman, I was able to connect with today's guest, Jim Hauser. Jim is a managing agent with Creative Trust Incorporated, Entertainment and Literary Management, and represents such major Christian artists as Stephen Curtis Chapman, Brandon Heath, Britt Nicole, Mike's Chair, all capital letters, by the way, Caleb, and Lindsay McCall. We'll provide links to Creative Trust and these artists on our website, so please give them a look and a listen. Jim, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you. And why did Amazing Grace not make that list?
Oh, well, I can't tell you that. You're going to have to go back and visit that podcast now. Again, it was one of my favorite ones, and so we were featuring it up on our banner there. And it's a rather interesting story that deals actually with the lyrical content of Amazing Grace, and it became popular in the mid part of the 20th century, but it wasn't too big back in the 17 and 1800s. So
I question the caliber of that list if it doesn't have Amazing Grace, so I'll have to check out the
You're going to have to. And when Robert Coote explains why it didn't make the list, and his list is based upon what was listed in hymnals of different denominations over 200 years, he makes the explanation. You go, oh, of course, that's kind of, it's somewhat obvious. But today, Amazing Grace does happen to be one of the most popular and most played hymns of all time. I got another question for you, too. I was mentioning this list of artists that you manage here, include Stephen Curtis Chapman, Brandon Heath, and I came across Mike's Chair, which is all written in capital letters. What's the deal there?
I think it's a branding thing.
Is it?
They've always spelled it and used it in that higher uppercase text, and so we've stuck with it.
Okay. It does capture your attention. So, and one thing that's been capturing our attention has been the Christian music industry lately. And I have to admit, I know absolutely nothing about the music business. But I do know that artists need agents and they need managers. So I thought before going into a general discussion of the Christian music industry, we'd start a little bit with your background. And first things first, I just want to know, how did you break into this business?
Well, I think most people in the music industry would echo your comment. I don't know anything about the music industry anymore either. It's changing under our feet as we speak. So to answer your question about my background, I was a broadcasting major out of Cedarville University. And
Now, where's Cedarville University? We have a lot of cedars up here in the Pacific Northwest, but I don't know where Cedarville is.
It is actually in southwestern Ohio. and it's a Christian liberal arts college. And I went there with the distinct idea of, you know, working behind the scenes in production, maybe some on-air work, but primarily the production on the radio or video side. And I was really interested in Christian music. I discovered it actually on the way out to college. I knew Amy Grant, but I didn't realize that there was a whole genre of artists doing that. And on the scan dial on the way to college, I came across a Christian hit music station and knew instantly, this is what I'm going to do.
Yeah, now what, I don't want to date you or anything, but what time period was this? Probably about the mid to late 80s?
1987,
okay.
I can tell you where I was on the Pennsylvania Turnpike when I heard WJTO in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. I can tell you the first four songs I heard, and it became this epiphany for me of this is the intersection of things I'm passionate about. Radio, always have been a radio fanatic, you know, hiding under the bed sheets so my mom wouldn't catch me listening to hit radio and Casey Kasem.
Yep.
So loved hit music radio, passionate about my faith, and then, oh my goodness, there are artists singing about their faith. It's music and radio and faith all coming together, and that sort of sweet spot in that triangle is what I went after. And so my first job out of college, though, had nothing to do with music. I wound up working at a talk radio ministry called Focus on the Family. I had no idea how fortunate I was to get that job. Just worked with some amazing people and had no idea the competition for that spot. Remember thinking after the interview, well, if I get it, I'll probably take it, and not realizing 900 people had applied for the job, and somehow, you know, God favored me to grab that. But it was talk radio, and I was more passionate, as I just mentioned, about music. And so I found some part-time work working at a satellite network out of Colorado Springs called The Word in Music. It doesn't exist anymore, but that station is still there. It was Q96, now it's Q102, and it was Christian hit music. And then on the weekends, we worked on a show that was utilized around the country, and it was called the Weekly Power Magazine. And it was myself and two partners, and we started on 26 stations. And the idea was it was sort of like an Entertainment Tonight format in the sense that we had specific features. We had about 20 features, but you never knew which feature was coming. And the music was new music, and before it got to the countdown. And we wound up on about 300 stations as we grew that show through syndication. And so that is actually how I wound up doing what I'm doing now, because I came in contact with the labels. I'd say, hey, Stephen Curtis Chapman's going to be in Denver. That's only 45 minutes from here. We'll drive up there. We'll bring the DAT player. We'll record the interview. We'll make it sound like he was in studio. I need 30 discs. We'll do this great promotion. I talked about this fast. I was this passionate. And the book on me in Nashville became, he's more passionate about our music than we are. And so when one of these jobs at the record labels opened up to pick the single and then call stations to get them to play the song, to play it more, it's called a national promotions director or a national promotion manager. They were like, we know the guy. And so they called me. I interviewed at two different places, and you know, I made a big list of the pros and cons of the two places, and one was Myrrh Records, and it was the same money and the same job title and the same everything, but at the bottom of the Myrrh list was Amy Grant, and at the bottom of the Sparrow list was Stephen Curtis Chapman. And though I loved Amy and really looked up to her, Stephen was someone that he was one of those first four songs I heard, and he really spoke to me in a way. It just resonated so much with how he wrote, so I selected Sparrow. Went to Sparrow, was at Sparrow for almost 6 years, worked in the radio department first, then moved to marketing and then artist development. And then labels shift. They shift their staffs occasionally. And on a particular day, I lost some of the key artists that I had worked with from the beginning of their career or the beginning of mine. Steven, Nicole Nordeman, Switchfoot, and Avalon. And I was pretty bummed about it. I was pretty sad. And about 2 weeks later, my phone rang, and it was Steven's manager. And he said, you know, Jim, we really miss you. We miss you. We want you back on our team. And I said, man, you call my boss. You know, there's nothing I can do about it. He said, you know, we really miss your ideas and your energy, and we want you back on the team. And I said, you know, my boss's extension is 6861. You know, I can't do anything about it. He said, no, you don't understand. We want you to come over here and be on our team. And so he was inviting a guy who had never managed an artist to take on day-to-day management of a platinum-selling recording act. It's pretty unheard of. But I had that opportunity because of the relationship I had developed with the manager and with Steven and my roles at the label. He said, man, Steven really trusts you, and I really trust you, and you speak with honesty, and you're passionate, so we can teach you the rest. And so I've been here just over 10 years now.
Okay.
And, you know, tell that kid driving to college in 1987 that the Stephen Curtis Chapman song you just heard on the radio, you tell him he's going to manage that kid, that artist, that iconic artist. I don't think he would have believed you. But here I am.
Yeah, well, you know, God works in many mysterious ways, and it's really interesting to trace the career paths of a lot of individuals, because many times doors are open and it might look scary on the other side, but sometimes you just got to walk through those things. Let me ask you about your current position right now. And so what's your official title, by the way?
I'm the managing partner for the music division of Creative Trust.
Okay. And so what does a day in the life, or perhaps a week in the life, of Jim Hauser, managing partner, look like?
Well, it could be anything. I mean, one of the biggest things I do is answer email and talk on the phone about various issues and opportunities for our artists. I might be meeting one-on-one with some of the people on the team that I have here that help us get things accomplished for our artists. I would likely be doing at least two label meetings, meeting with the label partners that our artists have. Very likely that I would talk on the phone to all of my clients at least 3 to 5 times a week, each one, if I can get them to call me back. You know, it's a potpourri, and basically the gist is, you know, we are serving our clients by, you know, filtering all the opportunities and the requests of them that come in, whether that's a publisher or a publicity request, or the radio department wants to talk about the next single, or the web guys want them to post on their Twitter, or, you know, just countless requests. The booking agent has called because we have a concert opportunity. All those things come to us, and then we, based on what we've discussed with the artist, know what to do and handle it without ever even speaking to the artist, or it falls in one of those categories where we feel like we need to talk to the artist about this. We bring those to them, and, you know, I like to say with Steven, he doesn't even have to make a decision on about 90% of what comes in, because from our discussions, I know what he wants me to do,
mm-hmm.
or we haven't discussed it, but I just know what he wants me to do. But then there's about 10% that it's too important for him to not answer that directly. It's a more intense item. I'll know he'll want to control, and so we'll talk about it and then go back out. So those are inbound. Then we also do outbound. Sometimes Brandon Heath will walk in and say, you know, man, I'm really passionate about Young Life. Young Life is the reason that I know Jesus. Young Life is the reason that I'm doing what I'm doing. What would it be like for us to have a discussion with Young Life about ways that we could work together? I call that outbound. The artist has had an idea. Britt Nicole wants to make this sort of record, and so she needs to talk to her A&R person about that. Okay, that's outbound. So that's inbound and outbound, and then I just we have another aspect where we kind of it's kind of a radar feel where we're always scoping for something else that is an opportunity or a linkage for our clients that we want to get. So it's those sort of aspects, and it's kind of this the artist being this. If you could picture a wheel, the artist being the center of the wheel, and us being that first rim outside that center. That's sort of how we view it.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like that's pretty consistent throughout the year, but does it vary according to the time of year, or perhaps what artists are doing if they're in the recording studio or if they are on tour?
It does vary greatly. You know, we're in a very busy period on Brandon's career. We are wrapping up a headlining tour. But and I'm talking to Brandon every day and sometimes multiple times a day, and Brandon's working 5-6 days a week, and we have interviews and we have tour dates, and we're working on the new album, or I'm sorry, we're working on the new single Leaving Eden, and he's doing interviews. We've just launched a Twitter and web campaign. It's very intense with Brandon right now.
Mm-hmm.
In January, I don't know if we'll speak, because once we get to the end of this year, he's going to have a little time off in December, and then January is going to be a intense sort of songwriting month for him, and that's not something he and I really need to talk about. That's something where he and his producer are getting time together. Then February through May, June, he'll be in the studio, and it'll just be check-ins, key issues that come up that I need to address, but really I'll be filtering everything so not much can get to him in that time. So that would be a slower period. As we get to the end of that period, though, I'll be needing to set up the album with the label and start to get people on his team excited about it, start to talk to the booking agent about what the concerts will look like through the end of the year, start to talk to other managers about who could tour with Brandon. So yes, it is very cyclical. My role gets really busy when we're launching an album or we're launching a tour. Very involved in those aspects. And then, then I wouldn't say it ever stops, but it certainly is slower. The unfortunate thing for us as a management company is we don't schedule things according to how we would like them to go. For instance, I'm very aware that I've missed the last 4 spring breaks with my family.
Uh-oh.
But there really isn't anything I can do about that, in the sense that, man, spring is a key time when we're launching albums and tours, and it just so happens that Brandon and Steven and those are spring breaks that we've had tours out for them. I would love to say, Steve, that really doesn't work for me because Brandon's really busy. Could we shift? Obviously that's not how it works. But we are very strategic with our artists' schedules, how it relates to their plan. It's sort of what I just outlined with Brandon, in the sense that we know we haven't taken any shows for him, any concerts between January and June of next year. We've had opportunities. We've had the chance to go on tour with other artists, but we haven't taken that to really unplug and give him time to write the next recording. And to have that sort of foresight and planning, I think, is really important in an artist's career.
Mm-hmm. I hear you too, because my spring break as a college professor never matches up with my son's spring break or my wife's vacation schedule. So that's always that can be frustrating. You always got to juggle that. One of the questions I have, and I recently had the chance to meet you very, very briefly. You were on tour with Stephen Curtis Chapman, Andrew Peterson, and Chris Wilson, and you walked down a hall And I don't know if you saw me, but I was the guy sitting on the floor with a cowboy hat. there I was. And so you're on the road. I mean, even though your offices are in Tennessee, here you are in Redmond, Washington, where the concert happened to be. And so you must be doing a lot of this work here on the road. And, you know, fortunately, we have cell phones and internet connection and wireless and all that kind of stuff now. But is that pretty tough trying to juggle a lot of this stuff while you're on tour with Curtis Chapman and crew? And actually, why were you on the tour? Why weren't you sitting in your office in Tennessee?
Well, I do occasionally go on the road to, you know, as I mentioned, launch a tour. The reason I was in Seattle on that night was we had made some changes to the crew, and I wanted to hear the show one more time after we had these new people in position, because I've got to make a decision. I've got to make a recommendation to Steven for him to make a decision for the spring tour. And so I needed to see and hear the show one more time before I could do that. And why did I pick that one? Because we've had, you know, 15 others since the first 10 or 15 of the tour were after we made the change. I picked Redmond, Washington because I have a great friend who's a really important radio contact in that city, so it was a chance to accomplish this thing for Steven and accomplish other things for my other clients and Steven with this meeting. So you're just looking for ways to accomplish many things. And then the last reason I went was because Steven flew home the next morning from that show and had 2 days off at home, and so that meant I had 6 hours on a plane with him pushed up against a window where I could ask him questions and he couldn't escape.
Yeah.
So, you know, you just go into those sorts of things. It is hard to do the job while you're on the road because the phone doesn't stop ringing and the email doesn't stop coming. But I've actually found I'm really productive on the road because I can just work a ridiculous amount of hours, and you know, it doesn't affect my wife and kids because I'm already gone anyway. And the road tends to, you know, the folks on the road tend to go to bed around 2, 3 in the morning because they're all fired up after the show. They tend to not get up until 11:30 or noon. So I have that whole 4 hours in the morning where I can just bang on email and get it all done. And the client doesn't even know that I'm not working on them in the morning. And then when they get up for lunch or whatever, then we can focus in and accomplish things. And then those long plane rides, I love it because the phone doesn't ring and I can just bang on email. So, it's, you know, the hardest part about going on the road is leaving my family. I have a beautiful wife that I do not deserve, and I have no idea how I convinced her to marry me. And I have 3 kids. And, you know, I have an alarm that goes off on my phone at 5:28 every night that says they're only 11, 9, and 6 once. And so I really try to maximize the time I get with them and to really be present with them when I am home. It's really hard, though, because this is a 24/7 sort of job.
Yeah. Let's jump ahead and talk a little bit about that. I was going to save that for a little bit later in the interview, but you have some experience here on the road and you interact with artists who are on the road, and it's got to be very difficult. There has to be certain challenges that a lot of these artists face. You know, Steven Curtis Chapman gets to go home for 2 days. I mean, whoa, that's only 2 days and then off somewhere else. So what can you speak to, or how can you speak to those challenges and what they face and how they manage them?
Well, I think with our artists, you know, having that thread of faith, I think that a lot of times the tour, if the manager puts it together right, if the artist puts it together right, you really wind up with a band of brothers out there. You really wind up with, you know, for instance, the tour that you saw, the Songs and Stories tour. You know, Andrew Peterson has been married for 16 years. Josh is a newlywed, practically. He's just been married a year or two. Man, the discussions on the bus are, about how do we manage that and how do we love our wives well and connect with our kids well when we have this job that takes us away so much. And then even when we are in their presence, we're always noticing things that make us want to write a song, which makes us drift away. How do we, you know, how do we be excellent at what we do, but also be, you know, men of God that love our families well, which is probably the most important job God's given us.
Mm-hmm.
So I think part of the way that's done is just you've got a band of brothers out there. They have devotions together each day. They pray right before they go on stage, and part of what they pray for is the show that night and for God to open hearts and for God to use what they're about to do. But they're also praying for each other about struggles they have and in their families or their personal lives. I know one way Satan loves to attack a tour is, you know, through technical issues, gear and things going bad. But another big way he does is to attack a, you know, and I'll just speak to guys because that's primarily who I work with, you know, just the struggle of the internet and the struggle of those pay-per-view movies. And I'm fortunate that the guys that I work with are honest enough to say that those are temptations, but godly enough to lay that before God and help, you know, resist those.
Mm-hmm.
But they're there. And I think, you know, having accountability with a pastor and with close friends is really something that we focus on as a management company and kind of nip at their heels about. I think that's another really important aspect. Having people that in their lives that aren't really impressed with what they do, and having people in their lives who won't be affected income-wise by their decision. You know, as a management company, we try to be mindful and diligent of our friendships with these guys, and of course, Britt and Lynn's too. But if we're recommending to them, hey, don't go on this tour because it's really important you have time with your family, that's affecting our income. And it's hard to do that. It's hard to do the right thing sometimes. I think we've been pretty good at that at CT. But I think also that it's important for them to have a group accountable, accountability group, accountability friends around them who, man, it doesn't matter what they decide, their income isn't affected. And we encourage that. We encourage them to have that.
There's some interesting points that you brought up there. When we think about the music industry, and you know, I'm a big country music fan, so I hear, you know, songs about the road and the temptations on the road all the time. And you know, I also grew up listening to a lot of rock and roll, and you hear all the temptations of groupies, the legendary stories of the Rolling Stones or Pink Floyd or some other group like that. And you know, you understand that these temptations are always present in those kind of vulnerable situations. And you know, Christian artists, as you say, you got a band of brothers, you're praying beforehand, you got a big support network here, but there must be some other temptations out there too. And the one that I'm thinking about, and it's one that affects academics as well, is that when your stature increases, when you're doing some great work, all of a sudden you're surrounded by a lot of yes men, and it really can stoke your ego to high proportions. I'm wondering if that becomes a problem. I mean, you're told that you are a superstar and everybody wants to be around you. And oftentimes those people who want to be around you don't want to tell you some of the bad things that are happening because they don't want to fall from the inner circle. Are those things present too?
Sure. Absolutely. I think, you know, because of what artists do, they wind up on a platform and they wind up with people applauding them and they wind up looking at radio charts that have them on top of the radio chart. So sure, I think pride is something that they all have to work to keep in check. And I just go back to what I just said. You know, you've got to have people around these people, these artists, who keep them accountable and knew them before they ascended or aren't impressed with their ascension or have been around when it wasn't all that great for a while. And I think that one of the reasons that managers get to stay in place with the really great artists is they are honest. If you're not honest, well, you know, that's probably served some people well. It's not something I'm able to do. I just feel like I have to be really honest and transparent with them about all the issues they're facing. It's too hard. I'm not smart enough to keep track of the lies, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
I do think, though, about, you know, and I don't know these guys at all, but there's a situation I'm thinking of with a major athlete who has just gone through a major fall morally. And I've thought a lot about, well, how would I handle that if I knew that one of our clients was not being faithful, and yet, man, that client is making us huge chunks of money.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, fortunately, I've never had to face anything like that. And I do think, though, that, you know, you've got to look deep inside and know, man, if, especially in Christian music, if that's happening, then how could God possibly be at work the way he could be, at least?
Mm-hmm.
You know, God can use anybody, obviously, but when there's an ongoing situation like that, I think we would have to step in, and you know what? That could tank the entire company. But I think that would be the right thing to do.
Yeah, some tough calls there. I'd like to move on now to talk about the Christian music industry as a whole. I guess I should take a short tangent, and as you mentioned, I did see the Songs and Stories tour with Stephen Curtis Chapman and Andrew Peterson and Josh Wilson. It was phenomenal. I have not been to a major concert in probably 10 years since my son was born, and we've kind of dropped out of that scene a little bit. And so it was really fun and enjoyable. So I want to kind of be the yes man on that part and saying that, you know, you were there investigating the tour. And so from my end of the audience, it was all thumbs up. But let's talk a little bit now about the Christian music industry as a whole. Now, you've been in the business for a couple decades now, and I'm assuming you've seen a great deal of change over that time. And in fact, you know, when you were talking about driving to college in the mid to late 80s there, if you had mentioned the phrase Christian music industry to someone back then, maybe in the 1970s or early 80s, you probably would have gotten a lot of blank stares from folks. I mean, there was Christian music, certainly, but it was usually a pretty small market share of any particular label, and it usually had to deal with gospel bluegrass music or something. But beginning in the mid to early 80s, you know, with folks like Amy Grant, Michael Smith, Stephen Curtis Chapman, and even some of these other new bands like Stryper, back in the 80s, the industry really exploded into perhaps one of the fastest growing genres in the music world today. So much so to the point where we can now call this an industry. So what happened during that time? Give us a sense of the background of the Christian music industry.
Well, I was just entering at that point. But my take on that is that because of the technology at that time and some of the money that was coming in to the Christian side of the industry at that time, because some of the mainstream companies saw the potential and the quality of music that was now coming out of that side of the business, that money, you know, injected into it, allowed it to go to higher levels. Which led to more artist development, which led to more marketing dollars and more awareness. So you just had some excellent artists, you know, and then people take notice of that and then have some income, some capital invested into that side of the business, which helped these companies grow to where they needed to get. And that's what's so hard about the business right now is that, you know, the income to these labels is just, you know, cut in half or more from when I got to town 17 years ago, there's less than half the people working in the music industry than there were then.
Wow.
And so, you know, when you don't have income, well, then how do you pay for the staff to market your iconic artists and develop new artists? And if you're not able to develop new artists, then it's a dying business. And it really is a dying business in many ways. Anyway, the old model is a dying business. We're down double digits every year for the last 11 years.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that, because it's a fascinating thing that's not only affecting the Christian music industry, but the music industry at large. And a lot of this stuff is due to the, you know, new digital formats, MP3s, the file sharing stuff. There's the big controversy in the late 90s about Napster being created and allowing kids to swap music without having to pay the artist. I assume that that's a lot of the challenges that the industry is facing right now, right?
I agree. My take on that is that, you know, when the piracy began, you know, one of the things I always say is if you have 10 artists in the room, you're going to have 14 opinions. And so,
yeah,
you know, there was no consensus in Nashville, L.A., or New York when the piracy started. Some artists thought it was great. Some artists thought it was awful. And so there was no consensus with the copyright holders about what to do. So they did nothing for 7 or 8 years. And then when they did do something, they chose to sue the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
Really smart. Not so much.
Yeah.
And so that runaway train was, you know, ran away for a long time. And so literally, you know, when I speak to college students, and I'm fortunate to get to do that pretty regularly, there are usually people, there are usually students that will admit in that classroom that they have never purchased a song. They've just never bought music. So there's a whole generation of people that just, they never had to buy anything. They think it's free, mm-hmm. and it should be free, and they're offended if it's not free. And so Steve Jobs takes us back to the singles format at a certain point. You know, some would blame him for, oh, that's the downfall. I think the labels were just in a position at that point that, man, any part of 99 cents is better than zero. And so then we shift from a time where we were in the 80s and 90s of, if you wanted that song that you loved, you had to pay $16.98 to get the whole album, because you couldn't buy just the song you wanted.
Right.
And so that's a pretty good model for the labels. But when you shift to a model where I want just that song, and that song cost me 99 cents, and the label gets about 74 cents of that, that's not real good. That's not a great plan. Oh, by the way, you know, think of an industry out there right now, the Gap with jeans, or a gas station, Texaco, where half of their product is stolen. How would they be doing? They would not be doing well at all. And in most retail industries, you know, the margin is 50%.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the all of the music industry's margin is gone, and so we're just struggling to figure out the new way to do it. And most students that I speak to would say, "Well, you know, the music should be free, but I'll go to their concert. I'll buy a ticket to their concert." And that's how I'll support the artist. Well, you know, concert revenues aren't the greatest either, especially for the younger, not iconic artists that don't have brands yet.
Right.
And so then it undercuts artist development.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all of what I've just talked about is in the more traditional industry setup, where there's labels and the majors, and now there's a whole other world, and this is the positive side of what the internet has done for music. there's a whole world of independent artists and young upstart artists that are accessible now that wouldn't have been in the old system. And so that's fantastic, and that's amazing, and that has opened up, you know, rap and country and, you know, genres that Christian music wouldn't have touched because it didn't fit in the bestseller mold of that traditional model. So now there's all these other types of music that have come to the forefront in Christian music, which is fantastic. So it's a huge financial struggle that I don't know. If I knew how to fix it, I wouldn't be on the phone with you right now and telling you. We'd be out there doing it. But we're still struggling to find our footing on how to do it.
Yeah.
And it's difficult. But, you know, this is where we are. There is no stomach in D.C. for enforcement of piracy. And so we've tried to come up with other ways to, entice the consumer to pay us for the music, in small ways at least. So,
well, there's also merchandising, and we were at the tour, and my son got a Stephen Curtis Chapman sweatshirt that he bought, and we bought a few other things as well. I mean, is the music industry trying to switch more toward that revenue stream now? Or, I mean, I always remember concert T-shirts, but, you know, is that a bigger portion or a more important portion of revenue nowadays?
It's definitely more important, but it's not new. You know, that was there before.
Yeah.
When you have these major artist brands like a Taylor Swift or a Miley Cyrus or a U2, I mean, they can charge whatever they want for these sweatshirts and these shirts, and, you know, people will buy it. They can pay whatever they want for a concert ticket. Those shows are selling out. They'll do it. You know, on the Christian side, we can't do that. The audience won't do it. They won't pay for it. They won't show up. And so we have a tougher struggle. So I think the top artists in the most popular formats are probably fine. They've probably just raised their prices other places and made up for it. And they're so iconic that when their album comes out, people are getting it anyway. But I think the middle artists are the ones that are really hurt by it. And then the younger artists are either not developed or give up after a record or two because there isn't the support that there would have been in the old system. Or they're just indie and, you know, don't get discovered on that larger scale, possibly. And an example of that would be Andrew Peterson, who has been around for 11 or 12 years, was on a major label, I think did two records with Reunion or Essential, and never quite broke through on the sales level. Well, he's continued to make music, and he's continued to make a good living as a great independent songwriter. But there are so many people that are walking up to us after these shows with Stephen and saying, "Man, I didn't know who Andrew Peterson was."
Yeah, I was one of them.
and yet they leave there, they fall in love with the guy.
Mm-hmm.
His songs are incredible. He's very endearing and very charming, a great storyteller. So, you know, to me, that's part of the sad part of what piracy has done. It's just chopped the label development budgets, and so those majors, who still have the largest reach, were able to get that music, you know, to everyone, and there was more of that. But I can't be too sad because, you know, the indie model does still work, and so you just have to trust that people who can want to discover music or finding it. Now we have Spotify and all these other ways to connect with music, so I'm hopeful that music discovery can still happen on a wider level.
Well, one of the things that Andrew Peterson did, and I noticed this at the merchandise table outside the concert venue, was that he writes books as well. So he seems to have a part-time job, either in part-time in music or part-time in writing, however you want to look at it. So I'm guessing that a lot of these artists, too, are it's not full-time artists. They have to find other ways to feed the family.
I think that's true and quite unfortunate because, you know, what could these artists, if they could devote everything to it, what could they accomplish then? But you know what? I don't want to sing, you know, oh, poor, pitiful us either, because we can't. We got to find a way to figure it out. You know, it's not going to change, and us complaining about it isn't going to change it. So we've got to keep working hard to figure it out. This is what the consumer has demanded, and that's our responsibility to figure it out.
Now, one of the things you just mentioned a moment ago was that the internet has allowed for a lot of new genres to flourish within the Christian music subgenre. So there's subgenres within the subgenres, and you're talking rap, you're talking metal, heavy metal music, glam rock music. You know, you mentioned country in there. Country's always had its religious roots, but you know, there's a lot of punk rock, for instance. You know, nobody would associate Christian music with punk rock, but you have these, you know, MXPX and other types of bands like that. Has there been a lot of criticism that you've heard or that's come your way that, you know, maybe this is inappropriate to be going in some of these directions or even possibly with some of these crossover artists that are successful in the Christian music industry, but then become known for just being punk rock artists or becoming metal artists, that they're accused of selling out?
You know, I do remember hearing that sort of criticism of Amy. I do remember hearing some criticism of the Switchfoot guys. I don't really hear that sort of thing anymore. I think that, you know, the Christian industry demands of the artists that they walk a life of faith and they remain true to that. You know, they don't want the gospel embarrassed sort of thing, but they're not ticked off when Switchfoot's on Leno. In fact, they're pretty excited about it. And while, you know, Switchfoot, and I was Switchfoot's first radio guy, which was a pretty painful experience, because we had this amazing band, but their lyrics were not very overt. If you go back to the first two records, The Legend of Chin, those lyrics are not super overt. And so I was banging my head against a wall trying to get Christian radio to play those, because they weren't, I'm doing the quote thing with my fingers, Christian enough.
Yeah.
And so they were largely ignored in the Christian format until they had mainstream success. And that's pretty unfortunate. But since then, I think both formats have sort of embraced them. And the guys, they're just amazing guys. They are the real deal. They love Jesus. And they walk well in clubs and bars and arenas and churches. I mean, they're able to, I think it's what Jesus was like. It didn't matter where he was. He walked out his faith, and he loved people. And so I think that we have evolved to a place where a lot of that criticism is gone by the wayside now. And you know, to your point about the different styles of music, if that's too rock or too punk, I mean, I think you'll have people say, man, that is not my cup of tea. But, hey, it's a great outreach for that teen that, man, if they weren't listening to Christian punk, what would they be listening to?
Right.
And they'd rather, you know, they'd rather have that. Now, of course, I've just delivered my opinion from an artist in from an office in Nashville, Tennessee, America's Music City, and I run in circles where people are very endeared to that. That, you know, in larger America, it might be a bit more conservative, and my view may not be shared everywhere. But I think the majority of the Christian community is where I've just described.
I have a little bit of a smile on my face as you were talking about this, because we opened our podcast talking about why Amazing Grace didn't make one of the most popular hymns in American history, according to Robert Coote's list of this. And I'll reveal the answer now, but I still encourage everybody to go listen to the podcast by Robert Coop, because it's one of my favorites. The answer is very similar to what Switchfoot faced, is that it wasn't Christian enough when it was written in the 1600s, and people, it didn't have the word Jesus in it. and all the hymns at that time had Jesus in it. And if, you know, people said, oh, you're not talking about Jesus, it's not really a Christian hymn. And so it was shelved for, you know, a good 150, 200 years before somebody picked this up, dusted it off, and said, you know, this is pretty good.
Well, and I have an artist right now that we don't think will be embraced by what we would call CBA, the Christian Booksellers Association, the Lifeway stores, the Family Christian stores. And we don't think that Christian radio would embrace them because the lyrics are not overt enough. And yet we've had offers to sign them to a Christian label. We have not done so because we feel like they're not going to be successful in the CCM world potentially because they're not overt enough. So, you know, there still is the tension you're talking about there, but I don't think it comes as, you know, in the form of criticism versus the form of selectivity, going, well, that's great for them, but that's not really our format, so we're going to ignore them. Even though they're believers and there's threads of faith in the music, there isn't enough Jesus per minute, and so they won't make it in the format. And I'm not going to criticize my radio buddies. I understand they're trying to program for their listener, but that struggle is there in that way.
Mm-hmm. Let me talk a little bit about the show that I saw the other night, which was Steve Curtis Chapman's Songs and Stories tour. And he had on that show, as we mentioned, Andrew Peterson, who was phenomenal. Steven Curtis Chapman, love his music and stuff, but Andrew Peterson really stole that show, and my family agreed with it. It was really neat. And Josh Wilson up there, amazing fingers on the guitar, which was interesting to watch. Now, as I mentioned, I hadn't been to a concert in 10 years or so, and I was so used to the typical format where you have the lesser known artists come and warm up the crowd. People are still arriving and they're playing toward a half full house. And, you know, then that maybe the next artist comes by, they're a little bit more popular. Then you have your superstar. But one of the interesting things that happened during this concert was all three of them came out on stage together and they were playing their songs with the others. They were singing on each other's songs. And I really never saw that before. Is that something that I've missed over the past 10 years? People are starting to do it. Is it something specific to Christian music, or is it even just something specific to Steven Curtis Chapman and the group that he puts on tour?
It's specific to Steven and specific to this tour. It's something that we do fairly regularly in Nashville. We call them writer's rounds, and songwriters will play for each other on their songs, sing for each other on their songs, and they're sort of all on stage together. But as far as a larger tour, it's very, very unusual, and it's very gracious of Steve to do it that way. Because as you said, at 7 o'clock, Steven goes on stage with one of his biggest songs, and not only that, gives away the second verse to Josh Wilson to sing. And all of this is happening while people are walking in.
Yeah.
And so really they're, you know, what he's done is he's given his platform to Josh and Andrew in a way where they're not really openers. And it's very gracious of Steven, I think. And as far as playing on each other's songs and singing on each other's songs, I think you'll hear that talked about in tours. And you'll hear people say that, oh, yeah, then we'll do this, we'll play together. But the truth is, it rarely happens because you get right down to it and there isn't enough time in rehearsal, and maybe by the eighth or ninth show you work out somebody coming out to sing on, you know, part of a verse. But, you know, the intense rehearsal that went into this tour made it possible for what we're doing out there. So I'm really proud of Steve and what he's done with it. I think it's a phenomenal night, and
it was
something that we intend to carry forward too. That Songs and Stories brand is something that we intend to continue doing with other artists in the future, of course. But we love it. We think the audience loves it. And I will say one other thing: Steve is infamous for coming out to start the night.
Yeah.
He is not when you used the word for him earlier, superstar, I'm really uncomfortable with that term for him.
Mm-hmm.
I know he would rear up at it, because that's not how he feels about it. He just feels like God's given him this music. He's thankful to have this platform. And so, you know, I even remember going into a label and explaining to them that we were going to have their artist direct support play right before Steven. And then we were going to have an opening artist, but before that opening artist, Casting Crowns, came out, Steve was going to come out and do a song or two first, just him on an acoustic, and kind of set the tone for the night. And they just looked at me like I was crazy, because A, they didn't know who Casting Crowns was,
yeah.
And B, why would the headliner come out so early in the night? And that's just something he's done through the years. And by the way, I don't know if you noticed it, but his audience knows to show up. I mean, 90% of the room was full. They know Steve's going to walk out and start the night most of the time. So it's something we've taught his friends and fans.
Well, from this end of the audience, it was a phenomenal show, and I really like that format, because you see the cross-fertilization of the music and how it can be reinterpreted through other people's voices, and it became more about the music than necessarily about the artist himself, and it was just a tremendous show. I want to talk a little bit, just a few minutes we have left here. And part of the show that we had as well was tied in with Stephen's charity, which is Show Hope. And it became not only kind of an intermission part of the show, but it was worked into a number of different songs. And tell us a little bit about Show Hope and how Stephen works this in, and how you work with this in terms of integrating it into the concert and his work.
Sure. Well, with all our clients, they always have a cause. Sometimes it's just the cause of the gospel, but Brandon, as I mentioned, is passionate about Young Life and an organization called Food for the Hungry. So, we're always looking for ways to engage the audience on a deeper level, on a service level. With Show Hope, it's an organization that Mary Beth and Stephen founded a few years ago, and they... it's a three-pillar organization. They provide adoption grants. So these are funds that help families who would love to adopt but don't have the financial resources to do so. And so the Chapmans began that adoption assistance fund. Another aspect of what they do is they're involved in adoption policy. So, for instance, a few years ago, engaging the government of El Salvador by Mary Beth going to meet with their first lady and saying, you know, we really need you guys to provide birth certificates for your children, because, you know, not having a birth certificate doesn't make it possible for the U.S. adoption system to work effectively, and seeing that government move to a place where they then did that. So that's an adoption policy aspect. And then thirdly, it's orphan care, that even if we were able to motivate the entire church to adopt one child, there would still be orphans. There's over 147 million of them. And so there will still be orphans to care for. And so that's the other part of what Show Hope does. And we're just inviting the audience to join us through financial opportunities to assist the organization in what they're doing. And so Stephen's passionate about it, and his audience is responding.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, and finally, too, about what you have on the agenda here. You talked about some new up-and-coming artists. And you also talked about your friend in Seattle that you have in the radio business. I want to just let you give a few shout-outs to any of those folks and tell us what's going to be happening with CT and some of your artists.
Well, I am thankful for the renaissance that Stephen's experiencing right now. At radio, he's back at number one with a song called Do Everything. He had not made it to the top of the charts for a while, and it's great to see him back there, and obviously it's great to see my boss smiling again after all the awful tragedy they have been through in the last 4 years with
right.
the loss of their daughter Maria in that accident. So, you know, he is headed back out on tour in the spring, and the Recreation album is doing well and hopefully will be a great item this fall, this Christmas season. Brandon Heath is coming to the end of the album cycle on Leaving Eden on touring. We've toured in about 120 markets, so it's about time for him to sit down. We'll continue working that record to radio, but he's going into a cycle where he's writing, and I love when Brandon's doing that and interacting with him on the songs. I'm excited about that. Britt Nicole is in the studio now, and this is a young girl who is really emerging and hopefully about to just break. We think that she's a great answer to the Kesha's of the world, where it's, you know, it's fun pop music, and yet it has, you know, a redemptive and faith element to it, and it's something that moms can feel great about. So we're excited. We feel she's poised to really go to the next level. We're working with Steven's sons, Caleb and Will, right now on their music and what might be ahead for that. We are working with Mike's Chair, as you mentioned earlier, and their album, A Beautiful Life, is just finished up with its first single, and so we're continuing to try to develop that band. And then lastly, we have an artist named Lindsay McCall, who is opening for Casting Crowns right now and really connecting with the audience out there. That album's due out in January, and I'd love people to check her out, and that will be an artist we will struggle to get on the radio. The depth, and a la Andrew Peterson, there's a real depth and intricacy and layers to her music, and it doesn't always fit in the 3 minutes and 30 that my great friends at radio need, and so that'll be a really interesting project for me this year to see if we can somehow get the word to people to notice her. So, you know, we're really thankful to be at work on the things we're at work on, and the amazing caliber of people that we get to work with, and yet, you know, as I mentioned, there are financial struggles. So, you know, what I say to my team every day is, look, we're passionate about what we work on. That's all. We're only going to sign things we're passionate about. We're a little boutique sort of firm, and we'll work hard at it until we can't make enough money to do it. And then when we can't make enough money to do it, we'll go find something else to do. But until then, we're excited to get to pour into these clients and help them honor God and encourage and challenge people with the gospel.
I think that's probably great advice for those of our listeners who have sons or daughters, or even themselves, who are interested in, you know, carving out a path in this type of industry. You certainly, our discussion here has served as an inspiration to me and what you're all doing, and the concert that I recently saw, and the work that you're doing. So, Jim, I want to thank you for being here on Research on Religion. It's been a joy.
Very happy to do it. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.